all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossum.
And good afternoon. This is Jim Fossone with Veterans Radio on WAAM 1600 WAM. We're glad to have you along. At the start of the show, we're going to do some introductions and program notes, as we always do, and then we'll get on to our guests. We're going to talk about, this being Women's History Month, we're going to talk about women in service, talk to a couple of women who have served or are serving, and then we're going to talk about the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida. But first, let's start with a couple of reminders of upcoming events. We're trying to give you local events here in the Ann Arbor, Michigan area that you might want to attend in our listing area. First, the Michigan Paralyzed Veterans of America Annual Awareness Day will be happening on April 24th from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. at the Novi Civic Center in Novi, Michigan on 10 Mile Road. The Michigan PVA does a great job for our paralyzed veterans and veterans who have spinal cord injuries, so we would always like to support what MPVA is doing, and you can go to their website, www.michiganpva.org, to get more information, and we encourage you to attend and support the Michigan PVA. We're telling you each week also of an event coming up in May. The Agent Orange Town Hall is going to happen on May 9th at Northville High School Auditorium in Northville, Michigan. A number of speakers will be participating in that event. Again, you can learn more about it by going to www.vva528.org. So the Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 528 is sponsoring, and they'll have plenty of registration information and speakers, but we encourage you to consider going to the Agent Orange event on May 9th. But our special announcement today is going to be about the Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund. We've asked Lynn Phillips to join us and tell us a little bit about the work that the Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund does. Lynn, say hello to the Veterans Radio audience.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Well, we're glad to have you, Dr. Phillips, on the line. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Fallen and Wounded Soldier Fund does?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, we are not Wounded Warrior. We are not associated with them, as great a group as they are. We are not them. And I try to make that clear because that's the name people are most familiar with. But we are an all-volunteer group of private citizens here in Michigan, and we are in our 10th year of raising money for our Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. The primary thing we have done is to provide direct, immediate financial support to service-connected OEF, OIF vets who have pending VA claims. And in the 10 years we've done this, we've distributed to Michigan vets about $3.5 million.
And Lynn, let's focus in on that a little bit. Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund really helps the dollars raised here locally stay local and help Michigan vets and their families. Is that correct?
Correct. It all stays in Michigan, and 97 cents out of every dollar we take in goes directly to a Michigan vet.
Well, I've been to a couple of your galas, participated in some of the events, and you guys do a great job. Why don't you tell us what's coming up and give us some of those details?
On April 25th, Saturday, we have our 10th anniversary dinner auction fundraiser. It's at 5 o'clock at the MGM, and our guest speaker this year is Rob O'Neill, a name I'm sure everyone is familiar with.
Why don't you go ahead and elaborate a little bit and also mention that you're talking about the MGM Grand Casino in Detroit?
Yes. Yep, that's very same. Well, Rob O'Neill was the Navy SEAL who was in on the Bin Laden raid. And he, by his own account, is the individual who sent Osama Bin Laden on to meet his maker.
And this really follows a tradition at Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund of fantastic speakers. You've had folks like Ali North and Marcus Luttrell as guest speakers in the past, so I'm sure Mr. O'Neill will live up to that booking and not disappoint.
No, I'm sure he won't.
And how many folks attend your gala, and how do people either support it by sponsoring it or attending?
Well, about 950 people will attend this year. If they want to purchase tickets, they can go to our website, F as in Fallen, W as in Wounded, S as in Soldier, F as in Fund.org, and they can register online.
And is there still an opportunity for people, businesses in particular, maybe, who want to support the efforts of the Fallen and Wounded Soldier Fund?
Yes, if they want to provide a corporate sponsorship, or sometimes people want to sponsor vets so that they can attend, they can call me directly. I'll give you my office number, 734-929-4765.
Well, that's great. And I know the board is a group of local volunteers, and everybody working on the gala is sort of a local volunteer. As you say, there's almost 97 or 98% of the dollars raised go right to helping folks.
Yes, yep. None of us are paid.
And how did Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund come about? Why don't you complete our time available here with sort of a little history lesson?
Okay, well, about 10 years ago, you know, when vets started returning home from overseas, it was clear to some of our founders, Chris Cornelius, who's one of the remaining founding members, Constantino Del Signore, they noticed that there simply were not supports available for these returning men and women. So they started very small. They had a dinner. I think they had a couple hundred attendees the first year. And then as time went on and the word got out about just the tremendous need there is for financial support for Michigan's vets, people began to become more interested, and we had higher and higher numbers. Now we fill out every event we have.
And I think, Lynn, are you the chairperson of the Grants Committee?
Yes, yes.
So you see it on the helping give the money away to the veterans who approach you. And do folks do that by going to www.fwsf.org?
Yes, if a vet wants to apply for assistance, yes, that's the way they would do it.
Well, Lynn, we want to thank you and all of the people working and volunteering with Fallen and Wounded Soldiers Fund for what you're doing. We're sure that the gala on April 25th will be a sellout and successful, and we wanted to make sure we brought it to our Veterans Radio listeners. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's great. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you.
And
bye-bye.
Right after these notes from our sponsors, we'll be back for our next segment, so stay tuned.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're glad you joined us this Sunday afternoon. This is March, and it is Women's History Month. And as such, we thought we'd talk to a couple of women who have served our military and get some of that perspective. In studio with me is Brigadier General Carol Ann Fausson, retired. Hello, Carol Ann.
Good afternoon, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. And on the line, we have Lieutenant Colonel Mindy Herman, who is still serving with the U.S. Marine Corps. Colonel, how are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we're glad to have both of you here. This is a topic that when particularly speaking with some of the older vets, they sort of say, well, back in our day. Well, this gives both of you women an opportunity to talk about your day. so let's start, Colonel. We'll start with you because you're on the telephone line with us. Why don't you tell us what drove you to the U.S. Naval Academy?
Wow. Well, that was many years ago. Actually, I was just trying to recount that for this interview, and it was actually 27 years ago this May that I graduated, so even 4 years before that. So back then, back in our day, there was only about, I think, around 10% of women at the Naval Academy. And I have only one sibling who's an older sister, and she had applied and not gotten accepted. And, of course, the competitive nature of siblings being what it is, I thought I would try kind of on a whim and ended up getting accepted and went to visit and just absolutely loved it, so chose to go there.
So tell us a little bit about what drove maybe then your sister to think that the Naval Academy or a military career might be good for her.
Well, you know, she ended up not doing it, but, you know, like in our family, I think we were both, as many families, of course, are, raised in a patriotic household, and neither of my parents had served in the military, nor grandparents either, but I had always, and I think my sister too, thought it was a very noble thing, and when you're young, you look for those kind of things, I believe, to pursue as a career, perhaps. And so it was just, I think, the nobility, I guess, of the profession that at least interested us initially in the career path.
Let me jump to General Fausson. Carol Ann, I know your story, so this is a little bit easier. But why don't you talk about how you first got interested in maybe serving the country in one of the services?
Sure. And Mindy, thank you very much for your service and your continued service. I envy what you continue to do.
Right back at you, General. I admire you. You know that from a long time. So nice to have you on the line, too. So nice to talk with you.
Well, it's a little different for me. I mean, I am very envious of Mindy, not only her opportunity to go to the academy, but she's a Marine. Back then, they did not have women in the academy, and so I chose to go the route of appointment. I did not do ROTC, but I had this love, patriotic. My tata, my grandpa served in World War I, and my dad served in World War II and was a merchant mariner and then went into the Army, and so that continues even today. We have a nephew who's a Marine, and so that patriotic duty. My dream was to go into the Air Force, and I was a commissioned officer. I first went to University of Michigan and got my nursing degree, and there was this urge to serve my country.
I'm somewhat interested, Colonel and General, from both of your beginning days about when you started down this path, it wouldn't have been widely accepted. It wouldn't have been something maybe somebody thought their daughter or niece or sister should go into. What sort of reaction did you get, Mindy, when you started down this path?
Well, that's actually kind of a funny question because you are right. My parents were certainly surprised. You know, these days, and I know it from my own kids, I have a freshman in college right now, and I know that as parents, you know, we get very involved these days, but back when I was a kid, or at least with my parents, you know, they basically just let me fill out applications, you know, both of them, and, you know, were surprised, I think, that I had any interest in that at all, and I think certainly were very nervous about it, too, because it was kind of the unknown thing, and like I mentioned earlier, there was only probably 10% women, so that was kind of a little strange, and just how women, you know, would be treated, not only in, of course, at the Naval Academy, you don't decide whether you're going in the Navy or the Marine Corps till your senior year, so, you know, but they were concerned, I'm sure, how it would be for a woman in a certainly male-dominated profession once I graduated, be it the Navy or the Marine Corps.
In general, did you experience those same sorts of concerns from family members?
Oh, absolutely. I think my parents wished that once I came back, I grew up in Ohio, and after I graduated from U of M, I went and did trauma nursing, and I really think they wanted me to give this dream up, just for the fear factor.
And I know both of you are involved in mentoring youngsters nowadays as they consider either whether it's going to an academy or applying or enlisting even. Do you find sort of the same concerns play over every time, the same family concerns that you experienced maybe 30-plus years ago play out today? Mindy, do you bump into that same situation?
Well, it's funny because I have a younger daughter who's a junior in high school, and she's interested in the career path. Whether she does it or not, I don't know. But, yes, as a mother and not a Marine, we're all nervous. But I had a friend of my daughter's who applied for Academy. He was actually colorblind, so he was not able to go. But, his mother was concerned, as all mothers are. But I told her something which I don't have any statistics for, but I do know this, and I'm sure General will say the same thing. But, in the military, they take really good care of their assets and people, and we are those people. So, where a lot of college kids may be involved in some risky behavior, be it, drinking or drugs or driving or just really anything, in the military, at least my experience was that, they were always taking very good care of us. I mean, we didn't go anywhere for a weekend. And this is, of course, after I graduated, but we didn't go for a weekend without a safety brief. We didn't go a year without a flu shot or any other shots or a checkup, getting our hearts checked and just, so yes, certainly the military is a risky, endeavor at times. There's combat is very dangerous, no doubt. But if you were to look at it as a whole, I think that the Marine Corps and all services do a fantastic job in keeping all of their people probably as safe or even safer than the average college kid or young adult.
And, General, do you see that same trepidation on families today as you saw 30 or 40 years ago when you were going through it?
Oh, sure. We don't have any children, but I'm out there right now. I think I'm mentoring 14 young men and women from, all ages, high school. And, yes, sure, and talking to their parents, there's always those questions about what to expect. And Colonel Herman is really true about this. They're investing in your sons and daughters, and it's the best of the best. It's our future, and protecting this great country. And so, a lot of hours, money, and time is invested in these great young men and women. I wished more would become aware in the high schools about the great opportunities to go to an academy, an ROTC program. I think it's really special.
So Colonel.
If I could just dove in, because she said something I think that was really important is, there are so many opportunities for women and men alike in these services, all of them. And especially, I think, for women, because I'll give you another example using my older daughter, who I mentioned is a freshman at college. She got a few things for the military, whether you enlist or go officer route, same thing. But anyway, so she was getting some college, information as kids do. And one of the colleges, had a kid. It was a flashy, glossy picture of a kid in a cubicle in a very nice new building. And then one in the, for the military came, and it was this flyer of an astronaut, of a kid who had gone on to be an astronaut via the military or flying a jet. And it's just, there's just nothing that you really can't do with any of the services, for that matter, as your base. And I think, women don't generally grow up thinking, I'm going to grow up and be a Marine. Some do, but it's still not common enough where people go up and women grow up and think this is a real viable career choice. And it is too bad that they don't. And it really, working in recruiting as I have on and off some years, it's interesting how, you can't make a kid join any service. You cannot. But if you give them the information, then at least they know that it's an option. And I think that is a very important point that, General, you made, is if these kids knew what they could do, it really just opens several more doors for them of choices of what's out there.
Colonel, let's. You mentioned you made this decision to go into the Marines senior year of the academy. Talk to us a little about your studies at the academy, how you made that decision, and sort of the early career choices.
At the academy, you have many different majors, just like you would at any other college. You know, any of the academies are a liberal arts college, very highly ranked liberal arts college, those that compete with, you know, any of the Ivy Leagues in general. So, you know, you have lots of choices, and they're not all, really very few of them are specifically military related. They're communications or engineering or lots of different engineering choices, frankly, at the Naval Academy. I was an English major, but because there are so many engineering requirements, even with that English major degree, we all received bachelors of sciences because we did have to take engineering all 4 years. And then when you become a senior, they rank you in class rank, and it's not only GPA. It's not just your GPA. It's, you know, your physical fitness and your leadership and your all sorts of things. And they roll it up into a class rank, and it's kind of a fun night. They call you down 25 at a time, and you line up in order. And they have certain jobs that are available in the spectrum of the Navy and the Marine Corps. And maybe they have, like, I don't know, let's say 50 jobs for, you know, a certain kind of, you know, pilot, a Marine Corps pilot. And once, you know, those are all taken, if you're the next guy and it's not there, it's not available. But, you know, most people are able to get, I would say, their first or second choices. And I was fortunate that year. The Marine Corps ran out of spaces that year, so I feel very fortunate that I was able to choose the Marine Corps, which was even a smaller segment of people. Like, women was probably, shoot, only, I'm just guessing here, but maybe 5% at the time. So it was, you know, kind of a bold choice, perhaps, but it's been great for me, and I've really loved every minute of it.
So, General, once you graduated from the University of Michigan with your nursing degree and you were out for a year or so, you enlisted, and talk to us about that. Those early years, obviously, you were a nurse, so you were heading in that direction in the Air Force. So where did that take you?
Well, I got a commission, and so my first place, I was so excited because I'm an emergency trauma room nurse by trade. And so they said, you know, you're going to go off and do your training. And, boy, was that eye-opening, because I go into a hospital, and, you know, I'm a nurse, so this is going to be easy. And I get assigned to OB, and I'm like, what? And at that time, and so things have really changed. They did not put their nurses or their officers in the emergency room. They had the enlisted, the corpsman, ran the ER. And so very shortly, and you know, I was really disappointed, and I thought, oh, this just isn't going to work. You know, I went up to OB and I refreshed my skills, and we had several emergencies, and some things were occurring. And then, you know, I was pulled throughout the hospital. And so then they started a roaming supervisor. And so things worked out really well. So I guess even with disappointment, just hang in there, have some patience, some great experiences will happen. You know,
so, Colonel, I think I learned a new term in the last little bit, one I'm sure familiar to you, but this story reminds me of it, the term Semper Gumby. And can you explain what that means?
Well, I certainly can't explain the origin, but among the many colloquialisms of all services, Semper Gumby, Semper means always, of course, and the Marine Corps motto, Semper Fidelis, always faithful. But Semper Gumby is something you learn after being in the military all of 10 minutes, and that's to be flexible. Semper Gumby, the Gumby, the little green character that could bend in any direction.
So I think the General, your first assignment helped you learn what Semper Gumby was, even if you didn't know it. I suspect that story is familiar to you as well, Colonel, where you're told you're going to do X and you end up doing Y.
That is true.
We're going to come up to the news break here in a couple of minutes, and just so the listeners know, we're going to bring the Colonel and the General back on after the news to cover a few more topics. But both of you have devoted the majority of your career to military service. I guess I'll start with, I think I know the answer for both of you, but Colonel, let's start with you. Would you do it all over again?
I certainly would. Yeah, it's been very, like I say, it's been a lot of opportunities. So with that is a lot of excitement and things that you don't normally get to do if you're following a more traditional path. So I really have very much enjoyed it.
In general, I know you'd do it again. You'd sign up tomorrow if they let you.
Anybody out there, if you want to call me, I'm ready to go. 36 years, even after retirement, working with Legal Help for Veterans, helping our veterans. I just loved it. It has been the greatest honor.
Now, Colonel, you also got one other thing out of the Naval Academy, and we just have a few seconds left here. But you met somebody there who also had a big impact on your life, I believe.
I did. I did. So after your first year there, which is fairly tricky, you're a plebe, so you're the lowest of the low. And then the second year, they I don't know whether they do this any longer, but they used to scramble you, they'd say it, so individually into one of 36 companies. And so you'd get a fresh start. So I showed up to my company and met a young gentleman who I later would marry. So we've been married for, gosh, I don't know, 25, 6, 7 years, something like that.
Something like that.
Tell him. He knows. We go for accuracy on the day of.
There you go. Well, that's, again, there's all sorts of great stories that come out of years of service. We'll tell a few more of them here after the news. We're glad to have you listening to Veterans Radio. Please go to our Facebook site and like us, and you'll be able to follow the upcoming programs, and you can certainly contribute support by the website as well, veteransradio.net. We'll be right back.
Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online true2blue.com/military.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. We have Colonel Mindy Herman on with us and Brigadier General Carol Ann Fausson, retired, talking about women in service. Mindy, I'm going to start with you. One of the things we've asked you to think about and be able to talk to our listeners about is sort of what's been the best and what's been the worst assignment that you've had?
Well, I would have, you know, I didn't come up with the thing, but it came to me as you asked that. And I would have to say that it was as a reserve officer, and it was probably the same assignment. And that was back in 2006 and 2007 when the unit that I was serving with as a reserve officer, 124, 1st Battalion, 24th Marines out at Selfridge, was called to active duty to go serve in the El Anbar province in Iraq. And so my job at the time was that of the peacetime, wartime support team officer, which essentially was I was in charge of the remain behind crew. And so I did not go to Iraq, but was in charge of the many Marines that were still filtering into the battalion. And there was about 300 of them that stayed back. And we had a good portion of Michigan and Ohio at the time, several, you know, stations there. So what was great about it was there was a lot to do, and I guess I should start with what was bad first. What was bad is it was a tough time in Iraq. It was a very dangerous time in Iraq. The battalion of about 1,100 Marines or so suffered many casualties, 22 to be exact, and that was Marines who were killed, and then there were many Marines who were wounded. So that was very difficult. But what was good about it was really to be of service to the families who were affected. And of course we had, every family was affected, whether they were wounded or not. So I felt, I was able to do a lot of, hopefully, good for those families.
Yeah, I know you and I spoke during that period, and I know what a heavy burden it was, during, that time because the communication from the front back to the home front is, so direct and so quick nowadays that keeping those families posted was a challenge, wasn't it?
It was. We had a very robust network, and the way we did it was, you know, I guess specific to the Marine Corps at the time, but we had a very good phone chain, and not for stuff, you know, of the nature that I mentioned with people being hurt or worse, but for just passing general information. So, you know, there was a lot of, high points within the year that they were gone, too. I mean, a lot of successes that they had, and, you know, they did a lot of really great things, but it was a challenge. It was.
And General, I asked you to think about the same question. Was sort of over your career, what was the best assignment? Maybe what was the worst assignment?
Well, there's too many bests, but the one that kind of sticks out is my service was active duty, and then I went into the Michigan National Guard and stationed. This one was at Selfridge. When the 127th, we were selected as the first remote medical unit to go on a deployment and represent our country, and that was in Korea. And so that one was, you know, really exciting and a great challenge, along with being selected as commander for Battle Creek at the Air National Guard base. I went over there as the first female nurse medical commander and to work with a great group of people, is just awesome. I pull a team together. And then I think I want to just piggyback a little bit with Mindy, 9/11 and talking to families and, having to deliver the bad news. You know, that's a horrific experience to have to go through. That will stay with you forever.
Well, one of the, as we work our way to the end of this segment, I wanted to point out that about 14.5% of the active duty force are now women. Women veterans make up about 10% of the force because you got to take some time to move through that demographic. So both of you have served at a time when there's been a smaller percentage of women in service. Is there a woman mentor in your service career that you'd like to use the last few minutes to give a shout out to, somebody who you should recognize for the service that they help support you provide? Colonel, I'll start with you.
You know, I hate to dodge that question because there have been so, you know, many women. I think all the women that I've served with have been fantastic, and for that matter, the men have too. And if it would be okay, I would like to mention a few things before I go, if that would be okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So two things. One is because I am, you know, around the area as a reservist, I get to know many people in the Marine Corps still. And I know that this April 11th, which is a Saturday, at Ford Field, which is home of the Detroit Lions, the Marine Corps is going to be hosting an event for really anybody that would like to come. And it's called the Bulldog Brawl, the Bulldog being the Marine Corps' mascot, of course. And it will be a great opportunity for anybody who is remotely interested in the service at all to just come down and see. So the doors open at 10:30. We'll have martial art demonstrations. There's going to be drill instructors there. There's going to be a flight simulator, a shooting simulator. All sorts of opportunities, tables, enlisted and officer, you know, things. So if anybody has any interest, again, the date is April 11th at Ford Field. And then the other thing, if I could be so bold to mention, but during that time of 124, the Band of Brothers, I think as Detroit News and Free Press called us, you know, we are striving, of course, to build a memorial for those young men who gave their lives in service to our country. And anybody who's interested in finding out more about that, if I could mention the website, would that be okay?
Please do.
Okay. It's 1-24, so the number is 1-24, written out, battalionmemorial.bravehost.com. So, again, 1-24, battalionmemorial.bravehost.com.
Okay, great. And, Colonel, if you send me an email on that information, I'll make sure our other Veteran Radio hosts mention it over the next few weeks, and we get it posted on our website at veteransradio.net. General, before we run out of time, any mentor you'd like to mention and give a shout-out to?
Well, I think there's several. General Irene Trowell Harris, I mean, you know, it had to take a few women to go out there and literally wave the flag and promote and discuss this with other women. And I think I know Mindy does it. I will continue to help mentor these future young men and women, because it's always nice to have somebody behind and supporting you.
Well, we appreciate both of you for the service that you're giving or have given to the country, for showing young women and girls that this is a viable career path with exciting opportunities. And we want to thank you for coming to talk with our Veteran Radio audience. Right after these messages, we'll be back to talk with Hill Goodspeed from the Naval Museum in Pensacola, Florida.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. The General just told me we could have kept talking. I said, I know, but I've got other guests lined up. So you can't always listen to the General. So I want to first say hello to Hill Goodspeed from the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida. Hill, say hello to the Veterans Radio audience.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being with you.
Well, we're glad to have you on. Your National Naval Aviation Museum came to our attention because one of your co-workers, Mark Levitt, is a graduate from a local high school in the area where Veterans Radio broadcasts from in Ann Arbor. He was at the graduate of Plymouth Salem, so hopefully some of his family's listening in as well. And he was gracious enough to say, hey, the guy you want to talk to for this topic of women in service would be Hill Goodspeed. He's been with the museum longer. Hill, you have a undergraduate degree from Washington and Lee University. You picked up your MA in history from the University of West Florida, and you've been down at the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, I think, since 1994.
That's correct.
And tell us what role you served down there, and tell us a little bit about the museum.
Well, I'm the museum historian, and so my responsibilities are varied. I do a lot of the writing for the exhibits, appear on programs like this and television programs promoting naval aviation history or commentating on it. I also do a lot of management of the collections that come in, be it archival stuff or small artifacts or as big as aircraft, responsible for just the overall collections management of those. But primarily it's just to know as much as I can about naval aviation and be able to impart that knowledge upon our visitors, which number these days about 850,000 people will come visit the museum on any given year. And the museum's been open since 1963. June of 63, it opened on board Naval Air Station Pensacola, which is still where we are. We are one of the largest air and space museums in the world, and people familiar with naval aviation know that Pensacola is the cradle of naval aviation. It's the site of the Navy's first air station, which opened in 1914. So that's why our location is where it is. We have about 150 aircraft on display, including the first aircraft to fly the Atlantic, combat veteran aircraft, the only one to survive the Battle of Midway, record setters. So it's a great place to hang your hat every day for work and really to get a chance to spend the day just commemorating our nation's proud military history.
Well, most of us have never seen a museum quite like this, from what I can tell. By researching it online, with that many restored aircraft, how many acres do you have, and how many square feet under cover do you have down there?
Well, we're on a, I'm not quite sure of the acreage of our complex, but it's a number of buildings. We have a restoration hangar, but as far as display area, it's about 350,000 square feet, which includes an IMAX theater, in addition to other activities that people can do. For example, a lot of motion-based flight simulators that people can become a part of. And probably one of the greatest spinoffs of being in our location or great benefits is the fact that Naval Air Station Pensacola, since the late 1950s, has been home to the Navy's Blue Angels Flight Demonstration Squadron. And so every Tuesday and Wednesday during their show season, they actually practice at Forrest Sherman Field, which is located right behind the museum. And so the museum makes the flight line available right behind where we are, and to people for people to go out and see the Blue Angels air shows when they do their practices, and they'll sign autographs on Wednesday. So that makes us real popular during their show season, which runs from March through the first week in November.
Well, that's really interesting. The note I have down is it's the museum sits on 37 acres, so it's a pretty big piece of property that you have down there to display all of those aircraft. Hill, do you happen to know probably the largest? We have Yankee Air Museum locally, which is fairly small comparatively to that, but we also have in Ohio, Wright-Patterson has a museum down there at that Air Force Base. I don't know how the size compares. I don't know if you've ever
been there. Well, we like to say that for the Air Force operated those big strategic bombers, so they need a lot more space, which they have there. They are larger than us. If I'm not mistaken, I think the Air Force Museum may very well be the largest museum on one site. And Smithsonian has something called the Udvar-Hazy Center at Dulles Airport, and then they have the Smithsonian Museum downtown. So combined, those might be larger than Wright-Patt. But I've been up to Wright-Patterson a couple of times for various reasons, and it is really a great museum. And so between Smithsonian, Wright-Patt, ourselves, and the Yankee Air Museum and all those regional aviation museums that are located around the country, many of which have aircraft on loan from us, I think most people around the country, if they get bitten by the aviation bug, can find some place to go to look at some of our warbirds from years of old.
Well, that's a good segue here, because I think what our museums do is help fire up people's imagination, and they certainly help fire up the imagination of young boys and girls who might be thinking, boy, that'd be the coolest job in the world if I could fly something or work on something that went that fast. Does the Naval Aviation Museum have programs and exhibits trying to help ignite that imagination and fire of the kids?
Well, we certainly do. I mean, one aspect of it is just when they walk in the door. I mean, it's if you look at some of these aircraft, the early flying machines with all the fabric and the wires and the struts on them, all the way to the modern jets, it really it strikes wonder in your heart and your mind is looking at them and seeing, my goodness, look at that. So I think kids, their imagination is really sparked when they first walk in. But we do have some specialized programs for kids, both of which are run by our Naval Aviation Museum Foundation, which is a 501c3 support arm of the museum. The museum itself is actually owned and operated by the U.S. Navy. So their program one is called the Flight Adventure Deck, which they have a partnership with the local school districts in Escambia and Santa Rosa County here in Pensacola, and they will bring kids in for day-long science lessons where they go through and use devices and use aviation principles to learn about science. And then the most robust program is one that's been open a few years. It's the National Flight Academy, which is actually a week-long residence program where students come and they go into the Flight Academy, which is on the inside designed to look and feel like an aircraft carrier. They live in spaces that mimic staterooms on board an aircraft carrier. They dine on a mess deck, and while they're quote-unquote underway as part of their cruise, which on this building, which is called the USS Ambition, they'll hear the jet noise and the rumblings and everything that you normally hear on board ship. And what they do is they divide these kids up into teams, and they teach them about aviation principles. They have them plan missions, and then they'll go fly their missions in an array of cockpit simulators that are located in the facility. And so, like I said, it's a week-long event, and it's one that's very fulfilling and very rewarding, and And you never know. If there's a visiting astronaut or something who's flying into Pensacola and across the country, they'll have guest speakers like astronauts come in and meet with the kids. So those are some of the programs that we have that are looking to bring the next generation of aviation personnel into naval aviation.
Mr. Goodspeed, this is Carol Ann Fasson, and this sounds so exciting. How does a young man or woman apply for this week-long adventure?
Well, they can go to the National Flight Academy's website. So go onto Google and just type in National Flight Academy, and it'll take you right there. And there is an application online there, and you fill out the application, and you have to write a short little essay on why you think the National Flight Academy would be a great experience for you. They do also have scholarships available. There have been a number of corporate partners that have stepped forward for the foundation and put forth money to sponsor scholarships for children to come and spend that week at the Flight Academy, because the value is about $1,500 to come and actually spend that week there.
Excellent. And if a family wanted to come down and visit the museum, how many days, or is it, you know, just a day, would you think you could get a really good reflection of what you have to offer at the museum?
Well, I think plan on spending a good day there to actually walk around and see everything. I had a great uncle who was a PT boat commander of World War II. Now, he would spend 2 days because he would literally read every word that was written in the museum. But you can get a good look at the museum and see most everything over the course of a day. But we'd love to have anybody come back for a repeat visit the next day if they find they haven't seen anything.
And what's the cost for visiting the museum?
The cost to walk in the door is absolutely nothing, because we're a Department of the Navy museum. Now, we are on board an air station, so there is a checkpoint for guards to check your ID when you come in. So when people come to the museum, they need to have forms of identification for passengers in the car. But it doesn't cost anything to walk in the front doors. But there are IMAX theater, the restaurant, the motion-based simulators. Those are things that have a cost attached to them.
And over time, Hill, I think the museum's done a number of exhibits related to women in service. Again, this is March being Women's History Month. We're trying to talk a little bit on Veterans Radio about our women in service, and I know I think the museum's done some programming in that area. Maybe you can tell us about it.
We have, and they really kicked off one of our museum volunteers who had been an aviator in the Navy. She had really said, you know, we need to, let's do a full-fledged women's exhibit, because we had piecemeal stuff displayed around here and there in the museum. And so she got together with some of those with whom she'd served. We worked with our exhibits department, and we developed a really nice women in naval aviation exhibit. It's called From Typewriters to Strike Fighters, because the first females in naval aviation were yeomanettes, and they worked at the various air stations handling clerical duties. And now the women fly every type of aircraft in the Navy. So that's the title of the exhibit. It's a really not only it's a conventional exhibit, and it has some great artifacts, including a flight suit worn by the Navy's first female naval aviator, whose name was Barbara Allen Rainey, who was tragically killed in a training accident. But her original, one of her flight suits that she wore, the flight helmet of another one of her classmates then, Jane O'Day. It's got flower power from the early 70s on it, these various flower designs. And so you see, and then we also have some flight gear worn by a Marine, female Marine helicopter pilot in Operation Iraqi Freedom. So it runs the gamut. But probably the most dynamic aspect of it is a large screen, multi-screen video, which features interviews with women who've served across the spectrum of naval aviation, from the Navy's number two female naval aviator all the way to rescue swimmers and naval flight officers, aviators, and other aviation support personnel that are currently serving that we've managed to interview during their tours at NAS Pensacola. So it's a real dynamic thing, exhibit to really, it really exposes people to what women have accomplished in naval aviation. And it's always a great thing to see, particularly as the father of a young daughter, to walk by that exhibit at any given time and see young girls who are staring at that screen and just listening to the stories of what women have accomplished in naval aviation.
Hill, that sounds extremely exciting. So is this display only in March, or if I come down any time of the year, could I see this tribute to women?
You can come down anytime. It's a permanent exhibit in Hangar Bay 1, which is our newest building, which houses more of the modern type aircraft. And right across, it's really a popular area within the museum. It's located right across from a Marine One helicopter. So people can't miss it when they walk in the doors.
I noted on the website, Hill, that there has also been an exhibit, and General, if I didn't do this, you'd be after me, so called Nurses in the Skies. Maybe you can comment about that a little bit.
Well, it's that is actually part of the Women in Naval Aviation exhibit. We don't only cover those who've been in the cockpit. We've just covered women who have supported naval aviation in any sort of fashion. And in addition, starting with the Yeomanettes, we actually have an original Yeomanette a uniform from World War I that's in there. But flight nurses were really in naval aviation. They were the first women to actually go aloft. There were very limited number of them. I think there were about 200 of them trained during World War II, and they were the first women in the Navy to actually go in aircraft and fly into the combat zone. Actually, the first flight nurse entered the combat zone on Iwo Jima, and then followed that up with flights into Okinawa. So that is also part of that Women in Naval Aviation exhibit, telling that story of those medical professionals who supported the military with their roles in naval aviation.
So, you know, I run into college kids all the time, and I wonder about their the jobs or the course of study they're in. And when they say they're studying history, I go, "Oh boy, you're never going to get a job." I now know a historian who's got a really cool job. Hill Goodspeed.
Yes, I got very lucky. I actually I volunteered at the museum during one summer between my junior and senior year in college, and they liked what I did, and then I managed to do a program called a cooperative education program where I got my master's and worked there at the same time, and fortunately a position opened up for me. So it was being at the right place at the right time, and I'm the grandson of a World War II naval aviator. My father was a Marine officer, so it's a natural place to be, and it's a really fulfilling job to be able to interview veterans and to impart our proud history on all of our visitors.
And it's given you the opportunity to write a number of or edit a number of books on naval aviation, which also has to be a thrilling professional achievement as well.
Oh, very much so. I've been real fortunate to get those opportunities as well to write for magazines and to write and edit a number of books. So it's that's just a natural spinoff of my historian duties, just to acquire that knowledge and just another manner in which I can share it.
Well, Hill, we really appreciate you joining us. We appreciate that Mark Levitt, your colleague who's here from the Michigan area, turned us on to you. Can you tell us how folks can find out more about the Naval Aviation Museum, and if they want to schedule their trip, how they can get the right information?
Sure. Just go to our website, which is www.navalaviationmuseum.org, and that'll give you all sorts of details about, you can see the particular aircraft you want to see where they are in the museum. You can actually, if you can't make it down to Pensacola, there's a panoramic tour where you can actually go through our exhibit areas. But, of course, we want you to come down and spend actually come in our doors and spend some time with us. But there's a wealth of information on there, whatever IMAX theater is showing or movie is showing. So and if you have anything going on, want to do some research, Mark Levitt is our new archivist, so he's doing an outstanding job in the few months he's been there. So the folks up there in Michigan prepared him well for the duties he has with us.
Well, we're glad you were able to join us this afternoon on Veterans Radio. Thank you for your participation. I do want to remind our listeners to go ahead and go to Facebook and like Veterans Radio. Go to veteransradio.net to click on over. You can also go to the veteransradio.net to obtain a copy of the book we've produced this year called Best of Vietnam Stories from Veterans Radio for a contribution of $25. This program both appreciates all your support you give us by listening and commenting back to us, but also the monetary contributions that you send along. I do want to encourage you to go out and look at a book called Women at War, from the U.S. Naval Institute Press. I appreciate Judy Heise sending that to me by James Wise and Scott Barron. It's a really good read. And thank you for joining us on Veterans Radio, and you are dismissed.